Talking to Nick G, who I've known for what? I don't know, 5, 6 years. Maybe seven? What the
six,
hell?
Six, I think, or something. Yeah.
Yeah, you went to uni with my wife.
I did.
In Canberra.
Back when we all thought she was single.
And a nun, I believe. Wasn't that the term? Or at least nun-like.
I think maybe a young Julie Bishop waiting to happen.
Oof.
I got the feeling she wore pearls or something.
Jeez.
Could not have been more wrong.
Oh, that hurt. A young Julie Bishop. Imagine saying that to her. She won't listen to this.
I don't think so.
All right, well, your list of movies, which again, as often is, has been pared down and down and down again.
That one can't go first, by the way. We have to talk.
No, we're not.
We've got to build up to that one.
All right. Okay, all right. Well, now we know. But how hard was it to pare them all back?
It actually wasn't really that difficult, and I was kind of, I mean, there was a little bit of second guessing, but it was kind of, it was almost like, you know how J.K. Rowling said that she knocked together Harry Potter on a train ride or something like that, like she got off one station and it was all there. It was kind of like that. It was like, okay, I just kind of went, oh, okay, what movies do I like? And I was sitting at Woden Bus Interchange. Oh, by the time I got to Woden Bus Interchange, I think from Civic, it kind of, I was like, oh yeah, that'll do. And I wrote them on my phone, and then there were, I don't know if there were a few that I went, nah, we're not doing that. But,
well, I might, if I bring any up, just go, nah, we're not doing that. I like your comparison of choosing movies that you like compared to a seven novel series.
But I don't know that she did seven novels. I've never read them. But I think she only, you know, had like the story or the setting or something like that.
Yeah, there's a lot
it's
of
It's not
padding.
Quite the same. Hers is more impressive.
Well, to some people, maybe. They haven't heard yours yet, so we'll wait and find out. Well, we might start off talking about Jurassic Park, then.
Jurassic Park, yes. And for a little while, I debated this list, because the list is almost like a list of every like fairly well-received movie that made like more than $200 million while I was growing up.
I would have liked to have invested in nearly all of these movies. You would have done quite well.
And in some regards, it's a very, very safe list. But I think when I was a little boy, like a lot of little boys, I was very much into dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And I had like this book that I still have in my cupboard, actually. It's sort of like an old-timey paleontology guide sort of thing, and I would just read this thing over and over and over and over and look at the pictures and like, oh wow, you know, digging up. And
how like detailed paleontology? So how old were you when it,
well, I remember having it when I was in Bangkok, so I was like 2 to 5. I was had this book, so maybe I couldn't even really read it. I would just sort of look at the pictures and like, because it had all the different dinosaur types, so you could sort of look through it and see all the different ones and things like that. But it was very cool, and I really liked the idea of being able to dig up things. And in this house that I'm sitting in, which my parents have owned since I was a little kid, I used to go on like little digs, like out on the bush here.
Oh, yeah,
I'd put a little pickaxe in my bag and get a rope and wander outside and like smash some dirt for a little bit and go, okay, this isn't working that well. and kind of go home. But, you know, in spirit, in my darker evenings, I still occasionally harbor ideas of being a paleontologist. Like, I think about going the other way and going to like academia or something like that, I'd be like, yeah, that's the way to go.
Yeah. A little Indiana Jones in there too, or
I don't think I really saw Indiana Jones until I was like in my teens or something like that. We didn't have a TV when I lived in Thailand, so until I think we might have had one before I was two, but from when I was 2 to 5, we didn't have a TV, so I was a weirdo.
Well, I don't know. I guess that is a big difference for most people. But so, Jurassic Park came out in 1993.
Yeah, I was like 9. Or something like that.
And how many times did you see it?
I think just the once.
Yeah. Well, I know, but like some...
I went, my dad took me and he got me a hat, like a Jurassic Park hat, you know, just like the ones in the movie.
Yeah.
That had
Wow.
You know, it was like a prop or something, man. So it was like I used to pretend that I worked there.
I was going to say, like, did you think he'd been there? And
no, I knew he got it from the concession staff, but I would pretend that I worked there, and I wanted to be Alan Grant, and I would have like a little denim shirt that I would wear, and like maybe roll up the sleeves, and maybe have a little red kerchief or something like that around my neck, and I was very much into it.
Yeah, well, as you would. Wasn't it like one of the first movies that you saw? Did you get into the expectation? Was your expectation Mammoth?
I don't remember. I think a lot of these movies, because you didn't really see trailers or things like that back then when you were a kid. Mm. You'd just be like, oh, this has dinosaurs in it or something like that. So I was thinking about this when I watched it again, and there was kind of, I didn't know what was going to happen, I think. So I kind of went through it at the same time the characters did, where the first time you see that,
dinosaurs that come running past.
No. The first one, is it like a Brachiosaurus or something, or Brontosaurus?
Eating the leaves and...
I don't think they say which one it is, which is why I feel... Brachiosaurus.
Yeah.
And the first time you see that, so I was like, wow.
Yeah, it's pretty... It still holds up, too. That's the ridiculous thing. It still holds up.
Yeah, I definitely think that... I mean, some of the Mayasaurs were a bit crappy. The ones that, like, they're running really fast.
Yeah.
And the way that they interact and the mass isn't quite right and the way they move across the frame isn't quite right. But it still holds up. Yeah. And I think what really impressed me about it was that to an 8 or 9-year-old, it seemed entirely plausible. Like, I had no idea what DNA was or anything like that. But then it wasn't just like... You know, in like the old timey, the Lost World, I think it was called, or something like that. They just go through a tunnel and they come out and they're like, oh, there's dinosaurs. They never died. This was something else because there was this element to it of technology and science. And I was really in awe of the fact that they could do this. And I didn't know that they couldn't do this.
Yeah.
So I was like, wow.
But it always comes up. That's the thing, that the movie, just the idea of getting something out of the amber, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And getting it out and getting its DNA.
Yeah.
But anytime anything like this happens where they find DNA and hope to clone, they were going to do it with a mammoth?
Well, yeah, they just found one recently. And one that was never, like, frozen and then thawed and then frozen and thawed. It was just frozen the entire time. It was half in and out of a lake in Siberia or somewhere. And so they reckon they might be able to do that one, I think.
Every time it comes up, they're like, everyone, their first thought is,
Jurassic Park.
Jurassic Park.
It's finally going to happen.
It's going to happen in my lifetime.
Yeah. And I read the book as well. And the book was kind of, it was a little darker in a way. And it had all this weird, crazy shit about chaos theory and, you know, which I, to this day, still have no idea about. It could be crap. I mean, it's one of those very fashionable sort of...
Everyone says like, a butterfly beats its wings and then it causes a typhoon.
I think that's in the movie, though.
Yeah, yeah. But that's all anyone ever says. There's a big gap of knowledge that people have. They just go, oh, yeah, chaos theory, yeah, butterfly, there's a typhoon. The
right.
End. The end.
See, the Tyrannosaur doesn't have any set patterns or park schedules. It's the essence of chaos.
I'm still not clear on chaos.
It simply deals with predictability in complex systems. The shorthand is the butterfly effect. A butterfly can flap its wings in Peking, and in Central Park you get rain instead of sunshine.
Why?
Did I go too fast? I go too fast. I did a flyby. No, give me that big glass of water. We're going to conduct an experiment. It should be still. The car's bouncing up and down, but that's okay. It's just an example. Now, put your hand flat like a hieroglyphic. Then. Now, let's say a drop water falls on your hand. Which way is the drop going to roll off? Over which finger or over the thumb or the other side?
Thumb. Let's see.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Right.
Okay, now freeze your hand. Don't move. I'm going to do the same thing. Start with the same place again. Right. Which way is it going to roll off?
Let's say back. Yep. Same way.
Same back. It changed. Why? Because tiny variations, the orientation of the hairs on your hands.
Yeah, Alan, look at this.
The amount of blood distending your vessels, imperfections in the skin.
Imperfections in the skin?
Microscopic. And never repeat and vastly affect the outcome. That's what?
Unpredictability.
All right. There. Look at this. See? See? I'm right again. Nobody could have predicted that Dr. Grant would suddenly jump out of a moving vehicle.
Alan?
There's another example. See, here I'm now by myself talking to myself. That's chaos theory.
But it was a cool movie. And I remember, you know, all these sorts of stories that you would hear about it, like, you know, oh, the dinosaurs were so real that the kids filming it were really scared when the T-Rex is coming in the car and things like that. And I believed it.
Yeah.
I was like, that is scary.
Yeah, it's the movie where, oh, it's on TV. Oh, I watched this bit.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, then this happens.
Yeah.
And he's an all right director, I guess, isn't he?
Well, he hasn't aged well, I think.
You mean like as a director or as a human?
No, I think you know, you remember when Spielberg was like, Steven Spielberg is the biggest director in Hollywood, you know?
Yeah.
And like everything he did was like, you know, the biggest movie and was winning tons of Academy Awards and things like that. And now he's kind of, he almost seems like a little bit old timey.
Yeah.
You know, a little bit quaint, a little bit sort of, he's not edgy, put it that way.
Yeah.
He's very, I'm family friendly after Jaws or whatever.
Yeah. Well, he did E.T. and Close Encounters and they're all about aliens, but they're all family friendly. Alien yeah. movies, weren't they?
Yeah.
But you're right.
I mean, I never saw Schindler's List until like 3 years ago.
Really?
Yeah. But we're not going to talk about that. Oh, and of course, the greatest thing ever in my life as like a 10-year-old or something like that happened to me, which was that they took some of the animatronics, I guess, and the models on tour.
Yeah.
So in Holland, where I was living, they actually had like the actual, some of the props from Jurassic Park. And I remember they had a raptor.
Yeah.
And they had the Triceratops lying on its side. And it looked really plasticky and fake.
Yeah.
And now I kind of think that maybe it wasn't the one that they used in the movie. Yes. Or something like that. And that's what I was trying to... I have photos of myself which I forgot to dig out before you came around.
Yeah.
And that was cool, man. I mean, that was like Hollywood coming to your, you know, butt crack of the world.
Yeah,
sort of. But you know, that movie was really good though, and I watched it recently, and it's really interesting, you know, the character of John Hammond and what he's trying to do, and he's kind of making the point that, you know, he's not gonna, it's a theme park for everybody, and he wants to deliver an experience for people that is real and that, you know, brings sort of happiness to people's lives, and it just goes spectacularly wrong. And
yeah, but come on, they're dinosaurs, like.
But nobody thinks, like, everybody's still like, yeah, they should totally do that.
Exactly, you're right. That's exactly right.
It's like when Oliver Stone talks about Wall Street, and he's like, oh, it was a really, like, cautionary tale. I wanted to show people about the evils of Wall Street. And everybody Gordon fucking Gekko. Watched that movie and went, yeah.
Yeah.
I want to be a Wall Street trader, man. Fuck that shit.
Slimy people would stab people in the back and make heaps of money.
And make heaps of money and do tons of coke or whatever.
Yeah, greed is good was like the line that came out of that movie.
Yeah.
As like almost a slogan for it.
And Money Never Sleeps was also in that movie.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. It was too.
It was the name of the sequel. And I thought he made that up. And then I saw the original. And
did you see the sequel?
No. But no, I saw the name of the sequel when there was a trailer for it or something.
Yeah. All right, we're going to move on because we've got a lot to get through. I want to talk about one on your list, which I watched like maybe a month ago for the second time, which is Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Right. Excellent film.
Yeah, which, again, if you haven't seen it, you should, because it's amazing film of the genre, and it's just,
what?
If you're a fan of action movies from the 80s, if you like Lethal Weapon... They should
Did
have
you think
that
it was Lethal
slogan.
Weapon?
No, but it's Shane Black. Like, it's the same writer. He directed it.
Yeah.
It's all of that just
the writing's solid.
Yeah, very solid. And was it the movie that brought Robert Downey Jr. back?
I don't know, because I still don't think anybody's really seen that movie. No, well, I'm constantly surprised by people who have seen it.
Mm.
Like, I went through this at work, and this chick in my pod was like, oh, yeah, that's a good one.
I think very, very... that classic style of a movie that nobody sees at the cinema and then people watch on DVD.
Yeah, cult movie.
Just pass it on.
But it was before he was re-famous.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was before just Scanner before. Darkly as well, which we also might talk about.
Well, we can talk about them together, I guess.
Yeah, well, no.
That'll be a bit difficult.
No. Well, no, yeah, I don't think we're doing that. There's a bit of cross-pollination in these movies. But Yeah, it's just a great movie. It has fantastic range, I think.
That's a very good point.
What is your approach on spoilers for the podcast? That is something I've been meaning to ask you.
I think maybe Kiss Kiss Bang Bang spoilers, we won't go into too much detail. I think we're pretty safe on the Jurassic Park run. we didn't give it. No one's sitting there going, what?
There's dinosaurs in that movie?
Yeah. But I whatever. If people don't want to listen to a podcast about movies and because of spoilers, then it's...
Well,
then they can stop and watch the movie and come back to it.
We'll try and keep it to a minimum, I think.
Yeah, but I mean, you're right. That's a very good point about the range of that movie.
Yeah.
It's and
because it's irreverent.
Yeah.
And it's witty and it's fun.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it kind of... There are certain scenes in it that I think are very moving. Mm. There's one scene, for example, that hopefully isn't a spoiler, where Robert Downey Jr. is hiding under the bed.
Yeah.
He's snuck into this house through a series of misadventures.
Hilarious misadventure.
Hilarious misadventures involving a dog. And, oh, no, that comes after that. But, and he's hiding under the bed, and, of course, this chick who's talking to one of these assassin-type characters gets offed right in front of him. And I think that is one of the best things I've ever seen on film, the shot where she falls down, and she's lying on the floor facing under the bed, and she sees him there. And she's got about 10 seconds left in her, and he has to try and, without talking, because the other guy's right there, try and convince her to reassure her and convince her to stay quiet. And I think it's really one of the most powerful things I've seen in a movie, and it really sticks with me quite often. So I think that's, you know, indicative of the kind of, as we talked about, range.
I think it's one of the few movies, too, and I guess I mentioned Lethal Weapon because I felt that was the same. Like, especially in the later movies, like, it's irreverent, but it's quite dark in places.
Mm.
And the other thing is, too, that if someone dies in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, there's consequence.
Right.
Like, emotional consequence.
Right.
Where there's, like, in most movies, in most action movies,
yeah,
and we might talk about our love of The Expendables in some detail and how much we enjoyed that in those two movies we went and saw together. But when you actually...
I think that should be edited out.
Yeah, no, it will not be edited out.
My list is already not going to win me any critical awards.
But no, it's true. Like, that Kiss Kiss Bang Bang has an emotional core where if someone, like you said, gets killed, he feels it, and you as the audience feel it, and Val Kilmer feels it and sympathises with him.
Mm.
There's not like a, oh, yeah, whatever, let's move on and see what's... Like, he's in a lot of action movies.
Yeah.
Like, if that happened in most action movies where someone felt bad that someone was dead, then it would be like, whoa,
what are you doing?
You're not a man. Yeah, that's right. He's doing the movie.
Well, that happened in The Expendables, though. You remember when the guy who wasn't Thor, we found out later,
he wasn't Thor,
was killed.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and there were some tears. And I think they read a letter to his girl or something.
Oh, yes, that's right. In one of these, again, probably second to that scene in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang,
right,
for emotional punch.
Right. And
anyway,
Val Kilmer is in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang as well.
Fantastic.
Who is, by all accounts, a terrible actor and a bad, bad person.
And a crazy person.
And a tool, from what I hear.
Yeah.
Sorry, Val Kilmer, if you're listening to this.
Sure is.
But, and he's in that movie, and he's excellent,
yeah.
And I don't know if his character, Gay Perry, has maybe not aged that well in...
I did watch it recently, and yeah, he's still fine.
I think it's good, but I did have that thought, you know, where it starts to nudge up against stuff that hasn't aged well, and you go, ooh,
yeah. Yeah, I guess the action... That genre of movies doesn't age too well in a lot of regards.
Yeah,
for decency and all that stuff. But
and that scene at the end where he's like smacking around that old guy.
Yeah,
that's heavy, man. And that's right at the end.
Yeah,
it's kind of a downer.
Again, like a.
But then Robert Downey Jr. comes in and goes, "Well, that's serious. Well, fuck him. He's creepy."
Yeah, that's right.
Whatever. Moving on.
But it's a movie that like it has consequences to it. Like he gets hurt. A lot in the movie.
Yes. And he loses parts of himself.
Yeah, yeah.
Metaphorically. And
literally.
And other...
But, But there's, that's
that he doesn't go back from. Yeah.
Again, that's what I've always liked in action movies. It very rarely happens, but when there is physical consequence,
right?
They're not like, whoa, I'm well, dust that glass off me and move on.
Anyway, it's a neo. I guess it would be a neo noir movie, yeah. Right? So it's like a detective movie,
yeah,
and set in LA in the present day, which was 2005 or whatever.
Exactly.
And it's excellent, and it has bad guys, and it has gunfights, and it has intrigue and romance, and it's got it all.
Yeah.
And it's a fantastic range.
So, where did you go from here?
Shut up, I'm thinking.
Okay.
Oh, by the way, this thing, single gayest thing you've ever done.
Evening, gentlemen.
Hi, we are so incredibly lost.
Mr. Van Shrike.
Hello.
You look chilly.
Come back inside.
Actually, I'm from back east. I'm kind of digging the cold.
Ah! Fuck! He's the one who said it.
Well, I can kill you here.
Harry, I was thinking some more about this reality versus fiction.
Oh, is that a fact?
Yeah, like in the movies when a guy comes up and sticks a gun at some schmuck's back and says, let's take a walk. All of a sudden he's got a hostage.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that.
Well, in reality, the pros like about 5 feet of separation.
5 feet, huh?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's so the schmuck doesn't take the gun back and make it eat out.
Doesn't that suck? I just hit you for no reason. I don't even know why. Watch it.
Tell us where Harmony is.
Fuck you, Mary.
You don't get it, do you? This isn't good cop, bad cop. This is fag and New Yorker. You're in a lot of trouble.
Anyway, we're going to move on because there's a lot I wanted to talk about. And the next one I wanted to talk about was American Psycho.
Right.
Okay, which will win you some street cred back.
Will it?
Yeah, for sure.
I think Kiss Kiss Bang Bang has street cred. Probably not a lot of people know that film.
No, that's true.
And if you don't, that means I'm better than you, audience. But
he literally leaned over the microphone so he could talk down to you all as well, which was very nice. Very nice of
you. Well, you know how it is, if you ever go on Rotten Tomatoes and you see, you know, everybody's top five films?
Yeah.
And fucking The Godfather is always in it.
Yeah.
And, like, all these other movies that are, like, you know, there's always, like, a few that, like, everyone says is a classic, and then there's a few that are, like, you know, like, maybe not as well-received or not well-known.
Yeah.
And people, I really think, consciously pick those sorts of films to try and balance it out a little.
Maybe, like, a Kurosawa film in there as
yeah,
well?
Yeah, maybe throw one of those in, or, like, a Bergman film or something, you know, just to... And they're like, oh, no, this is my favorite film. I watch it
all the time. Yeah, Rashomon's amazing.
It's like on Friends when they say Jennifer Aniston says her favorite movie is Dangerous Liaisons.
Yeah.
Whereas it's actually...
Oh, Weekend at Bernie's.
Weekend at Bernie's, yes.
Yeah. Again, Friends, I will not hear a bad word spoken of it. That episode where they do the trivia is one of the finest episodes of a sitcom TV you'll ever see.
But sometimes I do think that one hasn't aged well.
Oh, no, not at
all. I think it hasn't aged well, but then I watch it and I'm like, no, that's good.
Yeah. Because
it's always on TV.
I remember a guy I lived with, he said, we were watching one night and he's like, this is like in, hurt my head a little. It's in Seinfeld, that picture of Kramer where they say, he is a loathsome, offensive brute, and yet I can't look away. He said, I feel the same way about watching Friends. They're horrible people, and I'd never want to be friends with them. But I always watch and always enjoy it.
Well, initially, they were kind of like people, but then they kind of became caricatures as they got settled into the writing and things like that.
So. How did we get onto Friends from American Psycho?
Back to American Psycho.
That's
well,
a good tangent.
Because you talked about my cred.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so yeah, American Psycho.
Yes. Another one of the greatest movies ever made. Because I don't know that there's really any movie or property or book, because I went back and I looked at how many of these films were based on books, and I think it's most of them.
Yeah.
Which is a bit worrying. And I don't know if that's sad or if it's indicative of, well, you know, people just make films out of it. They're basically scripts. But
yeah.
It's a really, I don't think, any people who haven't seen that movie, it sounds like a kind of like a slasher movie or something like that. And it sounds like, oh, it's this dude and he's really fucked up and
he's a big businessman and yet he's killing people.
Yeah. And I don't think, you know, without seeing it, I don't think you get that it's funny, like that it's a comedy film.
That's right, yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah, and...
Like, a lot of people get killed, and it's kind of uncomfortable to watch, but it's definitely satire.
I live in the American Gardens building on West 81st Street, on the 11th floor. My name is Patrick Bateman. I'm 27 years old. I believe in taking care of myself, in a balanced diet, and a rigorous exercise routine. In the morning, if my face is a little puffy, I'll put on an ice pack while doing my stomach crunches. I can do 1,000 now. After I remove the ice pack, I use a deep pore cleanser lotion. In the shower, I use a water-activated gel cleanser. Then a honey almond body scrub. And on the face, an exfoliating gel scrub. Then I apply an herb mint facial mask, which I leave on for 10 minutes while I prepare the rest of my routine. I always use an aftershave lotion with little or no alcohol, because alcohol dries your face out and makes you look older. Then moisturizer, then an anti-aging eye balm, followed by a final moisturizing protective lotion.
So I think there's some really pivotal speeches in that movie where he talks about, you know, why he does what he does, and it's because he's in such agony of society. And he says, you know, his only two discernible emotions are, what is it, greed and disgust.
Yeah.
And it's what happens when you take our society to the extremes and people become so dissatisfied that they just start inflicting their pain on everyone else, like he says.
Yeah.
And there's no catharsis. There's nothing. It just kind of, it goes on.
Yeah.
And he can't. it's just weird because I think it's such a wonderful idea that all these people, you know, he's killing people and yet nobody recognizes it because nobody actually recognizes each other. Everyone looks the same. They all go to the same tailors. They all have the same haircut. So he's offing people and he's saying, oh, he might say, you know, oh, like I killed this guy. And people won't believe him because they're like, oh, no, I just saw that guy last week. You know, he's fine.
Yeah.
It's just, you know.
It's dark, though, isn't it?
It is
very dark.
Dark
comedy. Very, like, you have to say, like, there's plenty of comedy in it, but it's very black.
Yeah.
Very. And the book is, I mean, the thing that I liked with the movie is how close to the book.
Right.
It gets. That's a lot of times with books that are quite challenging in tone.
Yeah.
Like the translation, they usually go one way too far and either make it, we'll make it more serious or we'll make it more light.
Mm.
But I think they got that pretty spot on with that movie. It's one of the few movies that I've watched and felt genuinely troubled.
Yeah.
Not because of the murder, but just the whole sense. They get the tone perfect, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of those films as well where the book is really serves as a great extension to the movie because they can't pack everything in.
No.
And there's more in the book, and the book is certainly very difficult to read. You know, like 2 or 3 pages where he's, you know, dissecting a corpse and trying to have sex with it and like cooking brains and stuff like that. And then, you know, other stuff is kind of, you know, I don't know how he came up with it, but you know, he'll have 4 pages on, you know, where he buys his coat hangers, you know, which designer store and which brand of water is the best based on their sodium contents and things like that.
The whole music breakdown, like when he breaks down Huey Lewis and the News, and you're just like, oh my god, like.
And I still don't know what that is about to some extent.
I think it's just like we spoke about even before this, was that people like sharing their opinions and their thoughts, and I think it's just if you dig, if you sit down and say, tell me what you know, and I'm not going to interrupt you or judge you, or maybe not even listen to you, then people will just keep going and keep going every little detail that if they're passionate about it and not care. If you're sitting there and you're not making a weird face and I can't read that you're uncomfortable, then who cares? I'm just going to tell you everything I know.
Because I almost feel like, I don't know if they're his opinions, though, because it reads like a professionally written, tacky, you know, Rolling Stone review or something like that. Yeah. So I don't know if it's actually his opinion or if he's just read these things and sort of like memorized it, or whether or not that sort of buys into the whole idea of, you know, the mendacity of the 1980s. Was just like, you know, this slick sheen of professionalism that is just, you know, bullshit. Yeah. There's nothing really underneath it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, like it goes in a bit of a circle, because I think it got a resurgence, that movie, it seemed like, in the last 10 years.
Well, it's only like 10 years old, isn't it? Or it was 2000.
Was it 2000?
Yeah, it was in 1999, because I checked. After your 1999 is the greatest year of all time for movies. That one didn't quite make it, but they made it in 99, I guess.
Yeah, well, there you go. See, yeah, right.
Result.
But it just feels to me, like it, again, like I guess he wrote, who's the author again?
Brad Easton Ellis?
Brad Easton Ellis, yeah. He wrote it, you know, about the 80s, but it's obviously reflecting the time that he's writing it in as well.
Which was the early 90s.
The early 90s, I guess, yeah. So
91. So pretty much the late 80s.
I guess it's the same. The characters seem to run through it pretty strongly. The references are very 80s.
Yeah.
But I think the theme is holds up pretty strong. The central theme of business, and like you said, the meetings that you're in, all the conversations that you overhear where people just talk passionately or way too in-depthly about total bullshit.
Yeah.
That's just what a distraction to God knows what. Why do people feel the need to talk about how good their business cards are or how good this tie is?
Yeah.
You know, and you feel yourself get pulled into that. If you're in that world, all of a sudden you buy a tie and go, yeah, I like this tie. This makes me feel happy, or this makes me... Because I know you do, and I know I do.
Well, I'll buy ties?
Well, you know, like, you get sucked into that.
Yes.
And as much as you can sit on the outside and go, oh, God, this is pointless and meaningless.
Even when the rational part of your brain says, this is bullshit, you're still influenced by things. You can't help it. It's just this feeling, and it just gnaws away at you. It's frustrating. Do you think that one thing that annoys me, I think, about the movie is that it lapses... Well, I don't know if it's the same for the book, because I haven't read it for a while, but it kind of seems to lapse into incoherency.
Yeah.
Where you're not quite sure what's happening at the end.
The same in the book.
And the reason why that troubles me is you have these people, you then, you know, there always seems to be a certain group of people who are like, oh, did it really happen? And I always hate those people because, in my opinion, the entire boredom falls out of your narrative. You just lose all, like, any sort of emotional arc or weight or anything just by being like, oh, well, you know, he's crazy or something.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's the case at all. I think pretty much what you see is what you get in that film.
Yeah. But I think the book's very similar too. I remember getting to the end of that and going, wait.
Well, I remember it went on for a very long time.
Yeah. And I was like, wait.
Like, past where the movie ended or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Limped on for an extra 100 pages or something. And
yeah, but that's, yeah, where it was the similar feeling of, like, what is, did I miss something? And then I did the same. I chose to just not, to think, oh, is it real? And I thought, no, I'm not going to get into that.
Yeah.
It's exactly right. The narrative just sort of collapses. Uh-huh. And what have I wasted my time doing?
Or what does it mean? It doesn't mean anything.
No, it doesn't mean anything. It's just
the ramblings of an insane person.
That's
right. Well, I suppose that can have meaning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Well, it can have subjective meaning, I guess.
Right, that's the whole point. That's the thing. You know, like, it's all well and good to have, you know, like, to ask the audience to make that subjective call and have their opinion, but I always feel that's a bit of a cop-out, though.
Mm.
and that maybe
and it was all a dream.
And it was all a dream. Like that's pretty much, and it does work in some cases,
right? For example,
see, like for example, like The Usual Suspects is it the. That is a spoiler, so if you haven't seen it, turn off right now. There you go. Where the ending is basically, it was all a dream.
Right.
But done in a much clever...
It had a purpose. Yeah, it was exactly. Manufactured, though. Yeah. It wasn't like, yeah. You know, it wasn't like, oh, none of it happened.
No, exactly. That's exactly what I mean. Like I said, it's manufactured.
Right.
But it's still that same trope, I guess, that, you know, like you just at the end of the movie going, what you just saw at the end of the book, what you just read is, yeah. It's up to you how much you believe, how much, and if it's done well, then that's good.
Fuck you. Wasting my time.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure, like, being in the cinema when that happens, I'm sure that's what happens, like, at the end when the lights come up and everyone's like, and some people are like, wow, that's amazing, and some people are like,
and I think that is what really annoyed me about Inception.
Yeah.
The ending to Inception is that fucking take a stand, Christopher Nolan. Nail your colors to the mast and, you know, just be a man and call it one way or the other. I hate ambiguity and I hate the idea that, oh no, it's up to the audience to decide for themselves. Because that's not an answer.
Because people demand answers.
Right. People want to make sense of things.
Yeah. And it
and
saves...
you can't just leave it to them.
Yeah. And it saves so many annoying discussions in pubs with people who you like, oh, care anymore, fine.
Like Blade Runner,
yeah.
Is that what you were thinking of?
Yeah, yeah. Well, Blade Runner and Inception, like,
yeah.
Like, I don't care.
People tracking down the prop designer and
the
costume designer in Inception and be like, well, do the kids have the same outfit
finding
on?
Finding all the clues, or watching it and just writing down the clues and, like, no, I don't care.
Yeah.
See what else is on.
Moving on.
You know what else is on? Die Hard.
Die Hard. Die Hard! Die Hard. Which was also in Friends. I just realized recently it's the favorite film that I think Chandler and Ross always rent whenever they render an action movie. It's Die Hard.
Well, why not? Why wouldn't you?
I don't know that I really came to appreciate Die Hard until, I don't want to say very recently, but in a new light when I started thinking about this list and which were the best action movies I'd seen, because I think Arnold Schwarzenegger definitely is the greatest action hero of all time, no question. Like, he's just, you know, like, he's been in so many movies, whereas Bruce Willis has been in Die Hard and that and some few. Well, he's been in some good movies, but not like action movies, you know. Not like,
did you like the Last Boy
not
Scout?
Like movies.
Last Boy Scout. Damon Wayans.
I didn't see that one.
Well, I'll explain the Last Boy Scout. He plays...
I think I did see this one.
Exploring his range. He plays a washed-up cop with an alcohol problem.
Is that the one with Sarah Jessica Parker in it?
No, that's Striking Distance.
Where he played a washed-up...
Yeah.
Like, Coast Guard cop.
On a boat or something like that.
Shit, okay, well, I think he's been on a lot of...
The only reason why I remembered Striking Distance is because when I watched it, there was an earthquake.
And he was alcoholic in it.
Yeah.
But and he was really angry when...
Only two earthquakes I've ever felt in
Australia. Japan?
No, in Australia. Only two that I've ever felt. One of them I was watching Striking Distance, so it's burned into my brain.
Were you here for the one here, you mean? Was that one of them?
No, it was when I was on the Central Coast.
No, but was the other one here?
No, the one that was...
Were you here for the one here?
Yeah, but I slept through it.
Yeah, I got semi-woken up.
I think living in Japan sort of conditioned me for not waking up to small earthquakes. but anyway, getting back to Die Hard.
Well, what was the point? Oh, so that was the point of The Last Boy Scout, that you were in an earthquake?
No, Striking Distance was the earthquake. The Last Boy Scout, I really like. It's really cool. He's got a famous bit where it's, if we do this at the end, I'm going to dance a jig. And he dances a jig. Bruce Willis. Yeah.
He had a singing career.
Yeah.
Can actually sing.
Japan had.
I saw.
Bruce Willis
I saw.
CDs
you remember
everywhere.
When they had Super Audio CDs? I saw one of those was like Bruce Willis in concert, and I was like, "What the fuck is that?"
Sold a lot in Japan.
Well,
they're still there. When we went there, yeah.
He probably did Japanese ads or something.
Yeah, Bruce Willis, Eddie Murphy, all their albums.
Have you seen the Arnold Schwarzenegger one? It was like a. It's like a gum advert or something in Japan.
Oh, maybe.
He talks about it in his book.
There's quite a lot. Like, I think when I lived there, Richard Gere was...
Cash.
Richard Gere was huge.
Cashing in on the Koizumi thing.
Yeah, because he looked like Koizumi. So they did Dance like With Me.
And then they danced together.
They did, yeah. He did the remake of the Japanese dance movie, the Born and Dancing movie, and it was massive. The producers must have just been like, I know, we'll remake the Japanese movie with Richard Gere, who looks like their prime minister, and it will be huge. It's like the biggest movie.
It's like the inverse producers.
It's like one of the biggest movies in Japan in the 2000s was Dance. I think it was called Dance With Me, just because he looked like their prime minister.
Right.
Amazing. Just great. And Elvis singing prime minister. Anyway, back to Die Hard.
Right. So I didn't think I really appreciated how awesome it was until recently. And I don't really know that there's a better action film that I think I've seen.
I agree, really. I haven't sat down to think about it, but it would, if someone asked me, that would spring to mind.
Because what I like about it is it's not fundamentally ridiculous.
No.
Like, it's not jocular. It's not like, well, I mean, it's a little bit jocular.
Again,
but
the thing that grabbed me was when he walks on broken glass, he cuts his feet and hurts.
Yeah,
he
one
gets
of the
beat
best.
Up. He gets really beat
and
up.
And he's
in that
pulling
movie.
Like glass out of his
out
feet.
Out of his feet, yeah.
And that, he's really fucked up at the end of that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's why it's such a great movie, is because it has weight behind it. Yeah. Like, he hasn't had like years of off camera special forces training, you know.
Exactly.
He's just, he's a policeman, so he knows how to fire a gun, but he's not Rambo.
No.
And he's trapped in this building, and his wife is taken hostage, and he's severely outnumbered.
Yeah.
He can't escape.
Yeah.
He's got no shoes on.
Plus, what he does to get out of these situations isn't like MacGyver-esque. Like, he doesn't do, wait, I know, I'll use this and I'll use this. It's all,
when he makes the chair explosive, that's pretty cool, though.
Yeah.
I don't believe that he would actually know how to do that.
You're
or
right.
or you would do it and it wouldn't work in real life. It would just drop to the bottom of the lift shaft and it'd be like, wow. But so he does seem to have a bit more explosives training
you're
than maybe
right.
like
you're
a New York
right,
City
though,
police
yeah.
cop should have.
Yeah.
But he's not like stand and fight and just like mowing down terrorists.
Yeah.
It's guerrilla and it's hit and run, and he has to take them one at a time, and he's very vulnerable
yeah.
the entire time, is my feeling. And he's not even trying really to, he's not trying to fight them. He's trying to bring the police in and sit back, but then it just keeps going wrong, and he keeps getting involved, and, you know.
Can't stop getting involved.
Can't stop getting involved.
But, of course, every hero needs a villain. And
Alan Rickman. What can you say?
Amazing. Hans Gruber.
Yeah.
Again, like you said, it's probably the best action movie, but he's my favorite villain in action movies.
Yeah. I'm having a hard time thinking of a better one.
Especially, like, I love his accent. Now I have a machine gun. Ho, ho, ho. Perfect delivery on that line. But there's the scene in that where he shoots the guy. Like, he's again.
Chicago.
Yeah, again, like, without, you don't need a bad guy to be like, oh, I'm going to kill everyone. It's just like, well, you're not going to tell me what I need here.
All right.
I'll kill you.
And he's almost indifferent.
Yeah.
Is his thing. Like, he doesn't give a shit about the people. He's just there for the money.
Yeah.
And he just wants to get in and out and get cleanly in and out.
Yeah. Again, if he can get out, then no one dies. If he
can
get in and out cleanly, then he's not going in like, I'm going to kill everyone.
Yeah, he's not a, yeah, but the thing about that movie I don't really understand is why he was in that crazy terrorist cell, you know, where they're like, oh, he was excommunicated for being such a badass or whatever.
Yeah.
When he doesn't really care.
No, he's not, that's true.
So what were you doing there? Thinking. He just woke up in that one day. He partied really hard.
I think any action movie you ever see doesn't bear thinking too much about, like, the backstory.
Well, it is interesting because I watched all these movies recently, and I got a lot more out of it than I did when I was 12 and, you know, watching it before, like, you know. And so when he's doing the CV of the Japanese CEO, Takagi, and he's, you know, like, you know, father of three, educated here, and he talks about how briefly he was interned.
Yeah.
So he was in an internment camp in the US as a Japanese citizen during World War II, like his family. And that's like, it's just like a really subtle, small little reference in there
yeah.
that I think really fleshes out a lot of story.
Yeah.
And I think one of the passwords, this other thing was, you know, they're trying to crack his password, and I freeze the screen and his and it was like, you know, the war history maybe with his dad or something like that, and it was all the battles he was in. So it was Pearl Harbor, and there was the bombing of Darwin and stuff like that. So just even little things like that like, really add a lot of depth to the movie that aren't obvious unless you're really
and again listening for very it. Far removed from your generalized action movie.
Yeah,
with none of that backstory. Like backstory is, like you said, oh, he's a special ops training, like some dude going in he's great at everything.
Kill a dictator or something, kick ass. Yeah,
now we've explained everything this man can ever do.
Yeah.
But it's got all the explosions.
It does, but I think it manages to scale really well in the sense that you never suspend disbelief watching it. I mean, even towards the end when, you know, there's like exploding helicopters and he's leaping off the roof and stuff like that. Yeah. Like, it all seems to be like a natural progression of itself rather than like...
And again, when he breaks through the wall, through the window, he doesn't just go down to break through the window.
Yeah, he's kicking on it with his bloody feet.
Swing out and come back.
And like all of the blood on his feet is matching against the... So then... And there's some... And good shots in that movie as well. Like... Some really, like, one that really struck me when I was watching it was there's the shot where he's fighting on the roof and he's involved in this sort of frantic back and forth firefight with these two guys. And in the very same shot, so you have that and it's very fast paced, and then it pans up and you see the blonde terrorist dude, Carl, walking very slowly and methodically, and the camera just follows him all the way around. There's this wonderful shot where he's, you know, stalking him like a lion or something. And it really impressed me. I didn't notice that one before. And so that was...
It is a movie that, like, I think you're right, it holds up. And if you watch it again, you're like, oh. I mean, you might watch it. I think a lot of people would watch and go, yeah, Die Hard. And then you're like, oh, this is a great movie. Like, beyond an action movie. Like, it's just a great...
And I didn't realize how old that movie was. It's 1987, so 25 years old. And it shows.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Well... Yeah, I mean, it starts... Okay, so he starts off on the plane, and, you know, remember, he stands up, and, you know, he's got his gun in his little vest there. And he's like, oh, don't worry, I'm a policeman. And they're like, oh, yeah, cool, see you later.
And
he goes into the office, and, you know, he gets kissed by a man, and he's like, oh, Californians. And he goes into the office, and that guy Ellis is doing coke on the table, which I never realized, because I was, like, 12. Yeah. And his wife goes in there and she's like, she tells our receptionist to go out to the party, and our receptionist's pregnant. She's like, oh, you think I can have a drink, right? And she's like, yeah, no worries, whatever. It aged a lot.
Probably very quickly,
on those things. So.
Yeah, you're right. Wow. Yeah.
And it's very much a product of its time. Like, if you look at, like, the concern, and again, in American Psycho, this was the time when America was really worried about being overtaken by Japan.
Yeah.
So they're going to overtake us. They're going to buy this country in 3 years.
I remember in Australia growing up, like, I don't know, before I was even 10, I guess. And just being impressionable and thinking, why is everyone worried? The Japanese are buying all our land. And, like, it's when you look back, you're like, what the hell was all that about?
Now it's kind of like a fading star.
I thought I told all of you I want radio silence until further...
I'm very sorry, Hans. I didn't get that message.
Maybe you should have put it on the bulletin board. But I figured since I
waxed Tony and Marco and his friend here, I figured you and Carl and Franco might be a little lonely, so I wanted to give you a call.
How does he know so much about this?
This is very kind of you. I assume you are our mysterious party crasher. You are most troublesome.
For a security guard?
Sorry, Hans, wrong guess.
Would you like to go for double jeopardy where the scores can really change?
These are very bad for you.
Who are you, then?
Just a fly in the ointment, Hans. The monkey in the wrench. A pain in the ass. Whoa.
Check on all the others. Don't use the radio. See if he's lying about Marco and find out if anyone else is missing. Mystery guest.
Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Unless you want to open a front door for me.
I'm afraid not. But you have me at a loss. You know my name, but who are you? Just another American who saw too many movies as a child. Another orphan of a bankrupt culture who thinks he's John Wayne, Rambo, Marshall Dillon.
I was always kind of partial to Roy Rogers, actually. I really like those sequined shirts.
Do you really think you have a chance against us, Mr. Cowboy?
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
Anyway, we're going to crack on because I told you, it's hard, isn't it?
There's so little. You could do one of these on just like one
movie. Yeah. But we might move on to A Scanner Darkly.
Right.
Which is, I think, probably the oddest movie on this list.
Is it?
Oh, without a doubt.
It's got indie cred, doesn't it?
Oh, it has masses of indie cred.
It was an indie film, I think. It was,
yeah.
Or like it was on Warner Brothers' little indie print.
Well, it's Richard Linklater.
Yes.
That's right.
Other films I've never seen.
Really?
Yeah, I never saw Waking Life.
Well, that would get you lots of indie cred if you'd said, oh, Waking Life, it's all about dreams and stuff. And
yeah. Yeah,
it's pretty good. I think you'd like that. It's
I don't know, but I think visually now I always associate it with A Scanner Darkly, the rotoscoping.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I'd like to see what is kind of. I kind of get the feeling it's a bit the same.
Yeah. Yeah.
Probably not, but that's my impression.
I mean, it's completely different story. Like it's just dudes talking about dreams and reality. That's what the whole movie's about.
Right, whereas in The Scanner Darkly, they're just talking shit because they're all on
Yeah, but drugs. there's no plot to Waking Life. It's just basically a discussion on what is reality and what a dream. That's the whole thing.
All right.
So it's not, there's no real narrative to it.
Would you recommend it for
audience? For sure, for sure.
Both of them?
Yeah, both of them, yeah. But it might be, I think, a movie that if you watched it, I mean, you know it within the first few minutes if you wanted to keep watching it.
Yeah, okay.
The ideas presented are pretty interesting.
Do you ever stop watching movies now?
What do you mean?
Like, I'm kind of one of those dudes. It's not like a book where it's going to take you 10 hours. Like a movie, you can just kind of suffer through it and be like, that was terrible, and then move on with your life.
I guess, yeah. I know.
It's not such a time investment.
I've never walked out of a movie, and I should have walked out of a few, but I'm never. Yeah, I guess, like, there's been a few where I'm like, it's usually if I'm tired, I'm not in the mood, and it's just not grabbing me, then I'll turn it off.
Okay.
And very rarely get back to it. But I think you'll know very quickly if you want to keep watching Waking Life. But anyway, Scanner Darkly, do you want to sort of go over the plot, if you can?
I don't know that I really get it.
No, I don't get it. That's why I was surprised. I was thinking, oh, maybe he can explain this to me.
It's about an undercover detective.
Yeah.
And it's set always 7 years in the future, whenever you watch it.
Yeah.
And he, there is this drug out there called Substance D, and it's a very, it's a very potent drug, and it's very addictive, and you only, apparently the whole idea is, you know, there's no, as they say, there's no weekend warriors on Substance D. You're either on it or you haven't tried it. And so he's trying to work his way up and find the source of this drug. And so while he's an undercover police agent, he is also an addict, and things start to get a little bit weird because nobody in the police station knows who he is because they wear these scrambler suits that hide their identity. And he basically, as a result of taking the drug, the two hemispheres of his brain, like at the corpus callosum, he starts to get cross chatter, and he almost splits off into two different people. So he's surveilling himself and not really realizing it.
Yeah.
That's not really, to me, I think, what the film is about. I mean, there's kind of all this plot about, like trying to find the source of the drugs, and there's a mystery and trying to stop the drugs from getting out on the street. But it's all kind of in the background, really. I don't think that's really what it's about. It's based on this book by Philip K. Dick, who's one of my favorite.
Yeah, I was going to say, you've obviously read the book.
I did read the book, and it's very loyal to the book. And I read it afterwards as, again, like an extension, like American Psycho. And if you look at my copy, it is just dog-eared, like every second page or something like that. And that's basically whenever I come to like a passage or an idea or something there that really kind of that impresses me or I think is worth noting or moves me or something like that. And that book is just completely covered with them. And it's kind of interesting because Philip K. Dick always said it was his most personal story that he wrote. And there's this list at the end. I don't know what type of... Because it's based on his experiences sort of living in this drug commune, yeah, like in the 70s or something like that. And there's this list at the end where he talks about... he lists all his friends and what happened to them, and it's like deceased, permanent liver damage, permanent psychosis, deceased, deceased. And he himself is on that list as having permanent liver damage. And so I think it's fundamentally about... Ostensibly, it's about drugs, but it's... And in that way, it's kind of, it's very interesting because it doesn't really have a moral aspect to it. You know, it doesn't say, you know, drugs are bad or they shouldn't be doing this. It kind of just presents these people in the sort of the activities that they're doing. But it's not really about this, it's not about this, but I don't even really think it's about the drugs. I think it's about, the drugs are just a symptom,
yeah,
of the malaise and the... what I think people who are into existentialism talk about, like, you know, is like nausea is the fundamental sickness of being.
Charles Freck, becoming progressively more and more depressed by what was happening around him, decided finally to off himself. There was no problem in the circles where he hung out in putting an end to yourself. You just bought a large quantity of downers and took them with some cheap wine. The planning part had to do with the artifacts he wanted found on him by later archaeologists. He had spent several days deciding, much longer than he had spent deciding to kill himself. He would be found lying on his back, on his bed, with a copy of Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead and an unfinished letter to Exxon protesting the cancellation of his gas credit card. That way, he would indict the system and achieve something by his death, over and above what the death itself achieved. At the last moment, he changed his mind on a decisive issue and decided to drink the pills with a connoisseur wine instead of Ripple or Thunderbird. So he set off on one last drive over to Tiny's Liquors, which specialized in fine wines, and bought a bottle of 2001 Azalea Springs Merlot, which set him back almost $70. Back home again, he uncorked the wine, let it breathe, drank a few glasses of it, and tried to think of something meaningful but could not. And then, with a glass of Merlot, gulped down all the pills at once. However, he had been burned. Instead of quietly suffocating, Charles Freck began to hallucinate. The next thing he knew, a creature from between dimensions was standing beside his bed, looking down at him disapprovingly.
The gap between yourself is this thinking, feeling, you know... human being who's been encouraged to, you know, believe in love and meaning and dreams and justice and all these sorts of ideals and things like that. Yeah. And then just the indifference of reality. And people getting into drugs, I think, are people who have this sort of life rage. And there are a few really sort of pivotal speeches in that film where he talks about... He used to have a family, and he kind of says that all of a sudden he bangs his head on a cupboard, and he realizes that he gets angry, and he realizes he's not angry at the cupboard. He realizes that he hates his family, and he hates his life, and his perfect house, and his lawnmower, and, you know, all the sort of trappings of modern life. And I think... And he says, you know, nothing new would ever happen, and nothing new could ever be expected. And I think it's just kind of the sickness of life that makes people get into drugs.
Yeah.
Or makes those characters get into drugs. And I can empathize with that to some extent. So I think that's why it's one of my favorite movies. And there was a summer where I would watch, I probably watched it about five times or something like this, and for whatever reason I was deeply depressed.
I was going to say, were you isolated at the time? Or,
I don't think so. No, I was, but you know, I was in kind of a weird place that isn't worth getting into over a podcast. And it seemed the emotional core of that movie was really, you know, sort of linked or very really kind of spoke to me, for using a very cliched phrase. And I think, yeah, it's just one of the most beautiful things. And the ending of it is certainly very bleak, where you kind of... the character's being manipulated for reasons he doesn't understand. And there's a lot of sacrifice in that movie. And I haven't really been able to... You know, when you ask people why they really like something, they have a very hard time explaining it. But I think if you watch it, it's really sort of evident and obvious. So you have to watch the end of the movie. And it's got Keanu Reeves in it, who apparently is one of my favorite actors.
Yeah, looking at this. Well, I think that's a very nice segue.
Into?
I mean, you're talking, I mean, watch this segue. Wait, A Scanner Darkly is about what's real and what's not, and then The Matrix,
right,
is about what's real and what's not. Yeah. Now, again, the Matrix, did you see? You saw it at the cinema?
Oh yeah, massive sleeper success of a film.
Yeah,
don't you think?
Well, again, I think the first movie you mentioned earlier about how, you know, they didn't really market movies and give so much away. I remember, I think about it now, like when Independence Day came out and they put an ad up 2 months before it came out, and thinking, that's crazy.
Yeah.
That's so far away. And now it's like year, like the, like,
yeah,
Man of Steel
is
coming out,
like,
soon, and they've had teaser trailers for months.
And
the Batman thing, they leak.
Please don't suck into their pillow. Like,
yeah, they leak photos from set onto stage. Onto the internet.
Yeah.
But The Matrix, I remember going in to see it, and knowing that it was
about something
going to be weird.
People
and amazing.
Kicking us.
Yeah.
And, like,
and a camera spinning. Maybe that was it. Maybe I hadn't even seen that.
Because you remember 1999 was supposed to be the year of Star Wars, right?
Yeah.
Because when did that
came
out?
Yeah, that's a good question. Did it come
out
after?
I think it was like a month before or something like that, in America anyway, because this is not when movies came out around the same time or around the planet.
No.
We had to wait like 4 months in Europe for Star Wars. But it came out, Star Wars came out May 19th. Because it's my friend Charlotte's birthday.
The moment of your greatest disappointment in life?
No, because I didn't see it until three or four months later, when I was in the US actually on my summer holiday with my parents, living my high flying lifestyle. And we went to this movie theater, and we were the only ones in there. And you know, we were like, we'll go see Star Wars. And the guy behind the desk was like, oh, really? Anyway, let's not talk about
anyway,
Star Wars.
Sorry, we're talking about... So
we have
Matrix...
limited time. We're not talking about The Phantom Menace. Fuck.
No way. So the Matrix came out, like you said.
Right, out of nowhere. Everyone was waiting for Star Wars, and I went into that movie having... I think I knew that Keanu Reeves was in it, and I'd seen like a picture of him, like, you know, probably on the poster,
cool.
With a big gun.
Yeah.
And glasses. And being like, yeah, time to kick ass.
Yeah.
And was completely and utterly blown away. Like, I don't think I've ever had another movie experience like that, where, you know, you're just, like such a bad cliche phrase, but blown away. Just sort of like, wow.
Yeah.
Physically stunned.
There's that, and I think I spoke about it in another podcast, but the moment where as soon as he takes that pill.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And then for the next 10 minutes,
yeah, you're
he's
like,
just insanity. Like, you actually go, what the hell? Because you buy into it immediately, so obviously the world of the movie, in such a quick time. That's, I think it doesn't get credit for how tight that script is, that it's however long it is before he takes the pill, you just buy into everything. So then all of a sudden the world dissolves, and it's like your world dissolving like that. Oh my god, when he gets covered in silver and then
and
the
then
camera
goes
down his mouth.
And
wakes up, it's just nuts.
But I think a lot of people, like, look back on that movie. That's one of those movies that, like, I don't think like, your kids won't get it the first time they see it, you know?
Like, won't get how good it is, or just
won't it won't get how good it is, you know? Like, won't get how revolutionary it was at the time. I mean, this, it won like 4 Oscars in like the technical categories or something like that, and just, you know, Bullet Time.
Yeah,
I mean, it's so, like, you know, fucking, what is that show on TV now? Green Arrow, I think, can probably do that.
Do that all the time.
Now,
huh?
Like, you know, several times an episode. But back then, you know, and you saw how they do it, where they would have, like, 120 cameras all lined up around it, and they would rapidly take it and then sort of stitch it together. That was one of the coolest things I've ever seen. And it was really kind of, it wasn't overused.
No.
It happened, there are a few sort of key scenes where it happens sort of very quickly.
Yeah.
And then it's gone. And it's kind of, you've just seen it, and you want to see it again, but you can't.
Yeah.
It's gone.
Just...
And the first time you watch it, you're just so in awe of all the, you know, the stunts and everything. And remember, this was before like fight training for movie stars was kind of standard, I think. So, you know, it's kind of like when you see an old timey movie, but maybe with like Harrison Ford in it, and they have like a fight scene, and they're like, and they kind of give each other a bit of biff, and then all of a sudden you have fucking Keanu Reeves doing kung fu.
You have Lawrence Fishburne leaping
through the air and like doing convincing kung fu.
Yeah, but like I said, you might not know who Lawrence Fishburne is, but you know, in normal life, a man that age normally wouldn't be doing this kind of thing.
Yeah, and so just wow. And, you know, the story completely sucks you in. I think, you know, probably the first time you watch it, you're just in awe of all the effects and you kind of just follow with the story and things like that. But that film is really, couldn't have been more influential, I think, on my life, because it really illustrated, there's a lot of depth to it that you can read it on a lot of levels. And as a 15-year-old boy who hadn't read anything pretty much, there was that level, but really kind of succeeds in packing a lot of different ideas in, and doing it really well. I mean, I have this box set now of it, and they have documentaries on there about, you know, the philosophy and the science ideas and the Matrix and things like that, and they, you know, because a lot of those, they have all these interviews with philosophers and things like that, and of course, so they're very articulate and they can talk about the sort of ideas in the movie and things like that. And you can steal a lot from them, because one guy says it's very rare, you know, philosophy is a really abstract subject. And it's very hard to get your point across effectively. And he says it's really rare that a movie can do so much that it's philosophically interesting, but do it in a way that actually interests people.
Yeah.
And I think it really, like, made me interested in, you know, there's a general sort of like tide of like anti-intellectualism or whatever in Western society, I think.
Yeah.
And this was one movie that I think that illustrated that you could have something that was fucking cool and interesting and smart and had a lot of depth behind it and a lot of ideas and really kind of rewards deep introspection and thinking about it and discussing it. That I don't really know any. I mean, there are movies that do something similar, but I don't think they succeed quite as well in so many different categories.
Have you ever had a dream, Neo, that you were so sure was real? What if you were unable to wake from that dream? How would you know the difference between the dream world and the real world?
This can't be.
Be what? Be real?
It's going into replication.
Hey, Buck.
Still nothing.
Let's go. Let's go.
Tank, we're going to need a signal soon.
We've got a fibrillation.
APOC, location.
Targeting almost there.
He's going into arrest.
Lock, I got him. Now, Tank, now.
Yeah, I think because, like, you could look at it as, what is reality. But there's right. like there's more to it than,
yeah.
than just what is reality. It's and that choice. Is, it's
and that is, as I say, it's like that is epistemology, and that is Plato's allegory of the cave. You know, yeah. you find out later. So that's this story from Republic. But then you have the story about Neo. Okay, so who's the one? And yeah. that's obviously like Jesus of Nazareth. And
did they hammer that home in the third movie?
Well, they did, but interesting. Well, we can talk about that. But the third movie, I feel, is really a kind of about Eastern theology. Whereas mm-hmm. the first one is kind of, you have Morpheus and he's like this John the Baptist sort of figure. But in the first movie, it's not even just Christianity.
Yeah.
It's, as the people on the philosophy documentary say, it's Gnostic Christianity, which is this competitor to very early Orthodox Christianity, which is this idea that the world was created not by God, but by a lesser God.
Yeah.
As a prison, and we are divine sparks trying to get out of these physical forms, get out of the rough, and ascend. And so I don't really know any other movies that kind of have that sort of shit. That. And especially in an action movie. Yeah. You know, in between, like dodging bullets. And so
I think it really made a lot of people rethink the whole action
right.
movie. I mean, critics must have just gone... Oh, action, what the hell?
Right, this yeah. is... yeah. And I can appreciate kind of... I understand people who didn't like the second and third movies, and I think you can definitely take that that position, and I think they do to some extent. I remember being very confused when I watched the second movie.
Well, I think I remember the second movie... Like you said, sparingly in the first one, bullet time, the trickery... like dodging the bullets,
yeah.
stopping the bullets,
yeah.
all that stuff was used sparingly. But in the second one, I felt like a lot of it was, look what we can do now. Look at this shot. Look at this angle. Look at this action sequence.
Yeah.
And it was just too much of that. Like, I know that's what people probably wanted. Like, they have to do it bigger and better.
The Burly Brawl was cool.
Yeah.
Like, and the problem was that it was played to death on, like, TV, that's like, true. Previews and stuff. So if you would have seen that just in the movie
yeah.
for the first time, that would have been a big impact thing. Yeah. But I think it was just kind of, you'd already seen it by the time you went in there.
Yeah.
And the car chase was boring.
Yeah, that was the scene where I was like,
yeah.
Hurry up.
But no, so I can see what people are getting at when they say they're not great films. But in terms of, they definitely... in a lot of ways are more complex and make a lot more of a nuanced statement than the original Matrix does in the second and third movies. You know, the first one is very much like the machines are evil,
yeah.
humanity is good, getting out of the Matrix is good. In the context of the end of the movies, it's not quite clear,
yeah.
you know, who's right and who's wrong, and you find out who started the war, and you find out that some people are happier being in the Matrix. And, but I think beyond... I mean, the second and third ones were sort of... It was more of the same, you know. The first movie was a deviation from the norm, and then the second and third are just kind of a continuation. That's true, yeah. Whereas the first one was so different, and I think really successful as well, because you had this... There's this wonderful mechanism where the stakes were real, because you can die in the Matrix, and not only that, he's told that he has to decide between him and Morpheus, remember? And if he goes in there, that he will die.
Yeah.
So you're living throughout the entire... movie on the expectation that he's going to die, you know, that he could die at any moment,
yeah.
which you don't normally have in films, I think. And so the first time when he's down in the subway, and the agents are scary in the first movie, in the second and third they're cartoonish, because yeah. against a Superman it's contrast material, there's nothing,
yeah.
but against him, who doesn't believe that he's the one or anything like that, and when he instead of he's, you know, there's that shot where he's looking at the stairway and he turns around to fight the agent, that
yeah.
was, you know, might have, it's pretty manly. Might have shed a manly tear. Might have
shed a manly tear. Yeah,
what can you say?
I do remember coming out of that movie in a state of, like, euphoria and just a pure, like, just laughing and joking with my friends that everyone was Agent Smith.
Hmm.
Like, it just immediately just resonated on so many different levels.
Yeah.
And then going home and probably going to bed and just laying there going, trying to process it all. But just the blockbuster effect of it coming out of it and just being so, like, hyped up about it.
And then being great.
And then just going, wow, like, how do you make a movie that good.
And it was, it's very interesting as well because it's morally ambiguous. Where yeah. what I think was so shocking is, you know, the fact that they're like machine gunning just security guards, and they say, well, if you're part of the system, then you're a threat, and yeah. it's legitimate for us to kill you if we have to. That's which right. I think is pretty fucked up. And you don't really like to think about it too much in the context of the movie, that they just go in there and shoot all these guys who are just, you know, punching yeah. a clock and have kids and things like that. Yeah. But,
yeah, good movie. Cool outfits.
The last, what I think is interesting about the DVDs, though, is that. The ones that I have, they have commentaries. And what I appreciate about the Wachowskis, and not the Wachowski brothers anymore, because, of course, Lana Wachowski now,
yeah.
Is that they didn't talk about the movies. And they could, because they said whenever we talked about it, it made people less likely to offer their own opinions.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think that is the good side of leaving people to make up their own minds.
Yeah.
It's not leaving it completely open, but allowing people to have their own interpretations and not ruining it for them.
Well, I think what it did too, it's just, as you said, I don't think it's been done since in an action movie, was it gave people a chance to have that discussion about all of those issues, about
yeah.
the reality that you see around them and the choices you make. And you can make that on a different level. I think yeah. that's the difference. It's not like, well, was this real or was this not real? It's about, well, how much do yeah. you buy into the whole idea, or do you buy into a bit of the idea? Or...
Right. And you can take yeah. it on a mechanistic level, or yeah. like on a kind of a spiritual religious level, where you know where he goes and eats the cookie at the Oracle, and then does that change his code? And there are some yeah. people who are into that, like a very physical explanation, and other people are like, you know, they yeah. read it on another level. But that, so the, on these DVDs they have the commentary tracks, they have by two philosophers like Cornel West and Ken Wilber, and then they have this other one with movie critics.
Yeah.
And they're pretty, it's a little bit sneaky because it's like, well, here's philosophers who liked our movie, and here's film critics who didn't get it. But the film critics actually like give really kind of considered criticism, and they say that the first one is pretty much a perfect movie.
Yeah.
And then they go into all the stuff that they hate about all the second and third ones, and they just sit there for kind of 4 hours just ripping the piss out of, you know, being like, this is terrible, we don't care about Zion. You know, the most interesting about The Matrix is The Matrix. Yeah. Why are you showing us this?
Yeah.
Why are these characters here? They don't do anything.
Yeah.
No one cares.
The whole relationship aspect was really difficult to buy into in the second...
Right.
The second one. Like,
yeah.
I was like, oh, like the whole... I remember that sticking with me in the first one even, like the whole Trinity saying that she loved Neo and, or that she would fall in love with the one. I was like, well, that took me out, like, was obviously written. Yeah. You know what I mean? You know when you watch movies
in
it? I just, like, very nitpicking to a movie that was, like, one of the greatest. The same to you, like, one of the best movie experiences
yeah.
of my life was going to see that movie.
Yeah.
Just being totally freaked out and then just being so happy.
But what was weird I remember about those movies is, I haven't read it for a while now, but there's a lot of depth, as we talked about, to them. And like in the third movie, when they're fighting in the rain and there's that choir going, I had the soundtrack to that movie, and you know, they're singing, the choir is singing excerpts from the Upanishads, so this like really old Hindu text, and the actual lyrics are about, you know, reality and immortality and things like that. And that is, so that is the indicative of the level that is sort of going on in those movies. And after listening to the philosopher commentaries, one of the guys, Ken Wilber, was heavily into spiritualism. And you can, in the context of what he says, you can go back and you can read the Bhagavad Gita, which is another old Hindu text. And it basically, the second half of that book has the entire ending of The Matrix Revolutions. And like what happens to Neo and what Zion means and what the Machine City means. It's fucking bizarre. But it's there.
Wow.
So if anyone's really keen, go and read that.
I think that's maybe like a good a point as any to wind up yeah. about like a lot of, like you said, a lot of these movies, like at first glance, you might think a pretty
middle of the road,
like you said, safe. big money earners, but they're,
you know, well received. They're
big money earners for a reason and not just for spectacle. I think that's the difference.
Yeah.
And I think that's always, it's what you want from every blockbuster, but you're never going to get, are those movies that close to perfection, are an amazing movie from their time and genre, but also like an amazing movie just to watch and to and not to get removed from and not go, oh, that's bad writing, or oh, look at that, that scene was rubbish, or
yeah,
Schwarzenegger's doing his usual thing, or you know, like you can watch those movies, but it's that list is holds up to any list that I've interviewed so far.
Yeah,
as movies that they're I want to watch again, and
but they're
watched.
Very they're kind of safe in a way. So
yeah, but they are safe. But your reactions and your discussion of them are completely opposite of safe.
Thank you.
Like
thank
I didn't you, think we were going to have a chat about The Matrix in such depth manner, or even Die Hard for a point.
Yeah, deep.
But there it is. Deep. Well, that's it.
I get the feeling you're wrapping it up now.
I have. I just did.